I'm Steve Turner, author of A Hard Day's Right.
Because did you sit down or get on the phone with Paul?
It was done on the phone.
Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah. I'm curious if you can just give me some impressions about what he had to say about this era of the Beatles' time together that you thought was maybe illuminating or surprising.
When I spoke to Paul McCartney in 2009, we talked about the end of the career because it was then 40 years after those events. And he talked about it being, on the one hand, a difficult time because everything was fragmenting with the group. But also, he said when he looks back, he could think only of the joy and the happiness and the great things they created. So those were the memories that he was left with rather than, you know, the sad times and the bad times.
And he had some specific comments about John Lennon's somewhat rancorous comments in 1969 and 1970. It didn't seem like he put too much stock in what John was saying. Can you reflect on that a bit?
Yeah, I asked Paul what he felt about... Well, what I was trying to find out from him was... When you talk about the partnership between Lennon and McCartney, it's always John correcting Paul's tendency towards sentimentality or whatever. And I was wondering whether Paul corrected John in any way, you know, what he kind of added to John. And he took my question wrong. He thought I meant that John criticized his work, you know, after the Beatles' career was over. He did, you know, he said some pretty bad things about some of Paul's songs. I wasn't actually referring to that. But what he said was, well, you know, John said a lot of stuff, but he later would apologize for it. Or he kind of said, well, wasn't John on drugs at the time? As though you could kind of dismiss some of those allegations. And I was actually particularly interested in, I specifically mentioned the song Across the Universe, because a couple of times in interview, John said that Paul had tried to sabotage that track by kind of not putting his full weight behind it in the studio. And Paul very strongly denied that. He said there was no sabotage, because I also remember that I think Paul felt that Let It Be was slightly sabotaged on the Let It Be album, because there's the funny sort of voice comes in. I think it's either after it or before it, where John says, "And Hark the Herald's Angels Sing," or something like that. Right. And it was John that was sequencing that album, so he kind of had the final word on that. But Paul wouldn't hear anything of it. He didn't believe there was any sabotaging going on.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you think about this period of Beatles history, let me ask you to encapsulate where you think the Beatles were coming into Let It Be's sessions in early January 1969.
I think by 1969, Paul had more or less taken over as the leader of the Beatles, simply because I think John was so lazy. I mean, John wrote more songs about sleeping and laziness and inactivity than almost any other songwriter, I think. And because he was in that kind of mood, and because he was getting closer to Yoko, I think that allowed Paul to take over, and it was Paul coming up with the ideas. I mean, he wanted a Back to Basics album, and I think the initial idea was that they would write these songs and then film them being performed in some sort of special concert. And then there was all sorts of arguments about whether the concert should be on a ship or whether it should be in a Roman amphitheatre. So, you know, it's quite a high concept of Paul's, and as we all know, it ended up being just filmed in Twickenham, just outside London, and you sense the kind of the group breaking up, that you've got four individuals with different agendas.
Let me ask you to troll through Let It Be now, and do you have a track list in front of you? Or
No, I don't know.
Okay, well, I'll call out a title, and then you can start the answer with the song title.
Right.
Two of Us.
Two of Us was written by Paul. Now, Linda gave me the background on this. When they met, when they were in London, Linda was very carefree, and that obviously was attractive to Paul, because he felt sort of confined in this Beatles bubble. And Linda kind of took him out of that. And she would say to Paul, hey, let's drive out into the country and get lost. And Paul would say, well, how can you get lost? And she said, well, I'll show you. And so they'd drive out into the country, and then they deliberately lose themselves. And Paul had such great fun doing this. You know, he felt sort of free, liberated from, you know, being in Abbey Road, being in hotel rooms, being on planes and whatever. And that's what Two of Us is all about. Just, it's me and Linda.
Yeah. I know a lot of people that listen to it, they sort of think there's references to Paul and John, but it sounds like it was more about their early courtship, Paul and Linda.
When I first heard Two of Us, I thought, oh, that's about John and Paul, because he talks about lifting latches and lighting matches, and it just sounded like a sort of boyhood in Liverpool. And the style of the song, of course, is very, you could almost imagine it in the Hard Day's Night era. It sounds like the early era Beatles, and that again sort of made me think it must be about John and Paul. But when you listen to it again, knowing that it's about him and Linda, and it talks about sending postcards, which is apparently a thing that they had going on between them.
Right.
Okay, and going nowhere, of course, going nowhere. That was the thing about getting lost.
Yes, right. So then John's I Dig a Pony.
I Dig a Pony is just, I don't know if there's a lot to say about that, because it's just, you know, John would more or less make things up in the studio and kind of throw lines out and throw words out and see where they would go. And, you know, all kinds of things would come out, maybe just things he read in the paper that day, just names he liked to play with.
Okay, well, you mentioned Across the Universe, but let's talk. I mean, I know there's a complicated history about, you know, it was written for and used on a charity album and such. Mm. But I'm more interested in maybe what you do know about just the lyricism or the song itself.
I think Across the Universe is one of John's most lyrical, most poetic songs. And I think it's a song about creativity, about inspiration. And it was something that he wrote when he woke up in the middle of the night. He woke up in the middle of the night with, I don't know, with the tune in his head, certainly with the words in his head. And he got up and wrote them down. And it certainly does have that kind of purity about it. It does sound like something that came to him fully formed. It mentions, there's a chorus of Jai Guru Deva. Jai Guru Deva was the Maharishi's guru. And when they were out in India, they would sing songs to Jai Guru Deva. In fact, the Beach Boys have a song that mentions Jai Guru Deva as well. So where it fits into the lyric, I don't know, but it was obviously, it may have been written around the time of, if not in India, then certainly around the time that they were in India.
Right. Well, then Mike Love was in India too.
So. Yes, that's where he would have got it from, yeah.
Yeah. So George's I Me Mine is this sort of interesting brief waltz. Tell me a little bit about that one.
I Me Mine is based on the idea of, you know, George was the Beatle most profoundly influenced by Eastern ideas, by Hinduism. And it's the idea that we... you know, too many attachments destroy us. If we're too attached to material things, then we don't get absorbed into God. And you know, if you think of the time that this was happening around 1969, 1968, when the Beatles are fragmenting, when many of the times that they meet together, it's around a table and it's arguing about contracts and money and whether they should go with Alan Klein or not. And George said that it was, you know, his head was full of, you know, what's mine, what's yours, you know, how we split this up. And that I Me Mine was a song trying to look at this situation they got themselves into.
I think I'll skip reference to Dig It and we'll move to Let It Be.
Yeah.
Let
It Be... Again, is a song coming out of all the bad situation that's going on with Apple, with the Beatles. Paul refers to that time as his hour of darkness in the song. And apparently he had a dream where his mother came to him and said, let it be. And so he kind of wrote the song out of that experience. It actually sounds like it's probably the most hymn-like of any Beatles song. It has the structure of a hymn. And, of course, they had Billy Preston playing his gospel organ on it, which kind of accentuated that feeling of a hymn. And with the Mother Mary, you know, when you think Paul came, came from a Catholic family, but his mother was a Catholic, and so he had that kind of Catholic background. And he was... he was aware that it had that hymn-like quality, and the Mother Mary image enhanced that.
Before I forget, because he has his stamp throughout this, both of these albums a bit, could you say a little bit about the Billy Preston impact on these sessions?
I don't know if I've got anything really useful to say. I know that I'm pretty sure the Beatles met Billy Preston out in Hamburg when he right. was very young. And Billy Preston had a gospel music background. I know he was in a group with Andre Crouch, who's quite a well-known gospel singer in America. There's a group called the Kojiks, Church of God in Christ. And Billy is really the only musician to play with the Beatles and be identified and photographed with the Beatles playing on their records. I mean, Eric Clapton's contributed, and there might be one or two other people that did something very minor on a Beatles record, but he was actually like the fifth Beatle for that period of time. And it did add that sort of gospel flavoring to Let It Be, certainly.
Yeah. So I've got a feeling, I've always kind of loved this song. Tell me what you know about how this came about.
Well, I've got a feeling is... two songs put together, and then this was becoming a bit of a trend in a way. I mean, they'd done it with A Day in the Life on the Sgt. Pepper album. So whereas the early collaborations of Lennon and McCartney were literally them sitting side by side, either each with a guitar or side by side on a piano and writing together. Later on, you get with A Day in the Life, Baby You're a Rich Man, and songs like that where a Paul song is attached to a John song. And they're quite effective because Paul's is normally the melodic, upbeat, happy little bit of the song, and then John's is the rather bluesy, downbeat part of the song. And they tend to work quite well. Yeah. And in fact, that's the sort of thing they did with Free as a Bird, wasn't it? I mean, it's essentially a John song, which has a bit of added Paul in it.
Right, and then when we get to Abbey Road, yeah. You know, basically the song fragments just kind of get, clipped together.
Yeah.
So One After 909, I know there's a sort of historic background to this one.
Yeah. One After 909 is certainly the oldest song on Let It Be. It might be almost the oldest song that the Beatles ever recorded as the Beatles. It was presumably written during the skiffle era, and a lot of skiffle songs were about being on freight trains, and you know the train was a popular image in skiffle songs in the 1950s. And you know, when you live this side of the Atlantic, the romance of America certainly at that time was very much tied up with you know, freight trains and cowboys and Indians and things like that. So. That's the kind of suggestion of it, and I think it was based on the sort of timetables that you would have at a British railway station. You know, so you're getting the 8:05 or the 10:10, or I'm getting the one after the 9:09. I mean, that was the idea.
And okay, next in sequence is the Long and Winding Road.
Linda told me that the Long and Winding Road was actually written about a road on Kintyre, which is a peninsula on the west coast of Scotland, where Paul bought a house in the 1960s. I actually went up there to do a story, like a travel story, based on Paul McCartney's Kintyre, and there is a very long and winding road that goes all the way along this peninsula. There's a slightly straighter sort of what we call an A road, and then there's this very twisty, narrow B road. It's a very remote part of Scotland, and His cottage is, or his farmhouse is pretty hard to find. We located it in the distance, a little sort of white building with a red corrugated iron roof. But this was something he was advised to buy in the 60s, you know, somewhere to put his money. But it became, Linda particularly liked the place. It was, I don't think it had electricity when they first went there or plumbing or anything like that. But again, Linda was the person that kind of took Paul away from all the, you know, all the goings on of the music industry and could take him to places where he could forget being a Beatle. And his little farmhouse on the Isle, the peninsula of Kintyre was one of his favorite places to go at that time.
Is this a Steve Turner original photograph in the book of The Long and Winding Road?
No, the photograph in the book came from, I think it was a Scottish Tourist Board.
Oh, okay.
Because Linda had told me about the road, and then when the Scottish Tourist Board sent that photograph, I looked at it and go, yeah, that is a long and winding road.
Very good, yeah. George Harrison's other contribution is For You Blue, and you kind of write about his sort of interest in just trying to track a standard blues. Let's jump over to Get Back.
Okay. Get Back was, this is when you get the feeling that the Beatles were literally trying to get back, to try and get back from all the kind of complications of, I guess, what they were going through as a business, but also the music had got so complex. And this was some attempt to get back to the music that had inspired them in the first place. And it's very much a Paul song. It's got lots of sort of invented characters in there. You know, who is Sweet Loretta Martin? I mean, there's no doubt there is no original. It's just some name that he liked, like Vera, Chuck and Dave in When I'm 64. He just used to like making up these names. And there were some sort of controversial verses about Pakistanis and things like that, which they, I think, just picked out of current newspapers at the time. They weren't meant to be offensive or anything, but they were just making stuff up in the studio.
Since this is going to cover the whole year, let me ask you to talk a little bit about the singles and some of the things done in between these albums, principally here now, The Ballad of John and Yoko. Which came out in between the records.
The Ballad of John and Yoko was written, obviously, by John about... I mean, I suppose it really should have been a Plastic Ono Band single if they had been around at the time, but it's a John song sung by John and credited to the Beatles. But it's John telling the story of how he and Yoko got married and the hassles they were having with the British press and how misunderstood he felt at that time. And it's probably a hint of what was to come in John's career, because he very much used to like to use songs as propaganda. He loved sloganeering. You know, he thought if you could do it well, that was a great thing to do. And I think he liked that sort of ballad tradition. I mean, there was a tradition in English and American music where recent news events were sung about rather than, you wouldn't read about them in the papers. They'd be sung about. And he was trying to do his own ballad about his own life.
Do you want to set up with maybe some introductory remarks about what they were hoping to do or trying to do with Abbey Road as a complete idea?
Yeah, I could. I mean, Let It Be was the final release of the Beatles, because it wasn't the last album recorded by the Beatles. I mean, Let It Be and the black cover and everything seemed to have that air of finality about it. But Abbey Road was their parting shot, really. And I think after not having used George Martin on Let It Be, this was an invitation to George to come back into the fold, that they wanted to work with him again. And they wanted to do another great album. And I heard George Martin interviewed recently, and he said that not only was it one of his favourite albums, but he thought that really had taken the Beatles about as far as they could go. It was he couldn't see anything beyond that they could have achieved.
I'm going to get into the tracks. I know there are a lot of stories about Come Together. that mash up to create this John Lennon story. Pick a couple though.
Yeah, Come Together started as a campaign song for Timothy Leary, the as the newspapers used to call him, the High Priest of LSD, who was campaigning to be, I believe, governor of California, and needed a campaign song, and John came up with this with this song that had I think Come Together was the slogan of Leary's campaign, and John started to write this song, which wasn't used for the campaign, and then John sort of took it back and reworked it as a Beatles song, and of course it's got a quote in there which caused him a bit of trouble later on from a Chuck Berry song, you know, Here Come Old Flat Top, and you can't just quote people and not pay them money, which John later found out.
Harrison's Something, certainly, gosh, just...
Yeah.
What a tune.
I'm always confused as to whether Something was actually written about Patty Boyd, George Harrison's wife. I talked to her, she seemed to think it was, but there are other interviews with George where he said it wasn't for her. But anyway, it was... I think it was inspired by a song of James Taylor, James Taylor being one of the first signings to the Apple label, and he had a song called Something in the Way She Moves. And George has taken that line and extended it into a song. As we all know, George was quite partial to lifting things from other people's songs, either consciously or unconsciously, and got into a bit of trouble with My Sweet Lord over that.
But I guess unlike Chuck Berry, James Taylor didn't feel like biting the hand that feeds at the time. Or
no, James Taylor was quite flattered, I think, to be incorporated into a Beatles song. And I think he was aware as a songwriter that he'd done the same thing with other people's songs. So, no, he didn't have any grudges about it at all.
Yeah,
I saw a review recently of... Somebody who's quite young was reviewing a James Taylor album, and they said that Something in the Way She Moves was influenced by the Beatles.
Well, that's why we need people like you writing these books. Yeah. So what's the deal with Maxwell's Silver Hammer?
I was told by Tony King, who was somebody that worked with the Beatles at one point, that John had told him that Maxwell's Silver Hammer was about the idea of karma, you know, the idea if you do bad things come back to you. And if you look at it in that way, there is this silver hammer that keeps banging people on the head whenever they've just done something bad. But it's quite a sort of jaunty Paul song with a lot of characters in, as Paul likes to invent sort of almost like cartoon type characters.
And I know there's not a lot in your book about Oh Darling, but I think there's a little bit about just sort of the sound and how they wanted it, how Paul wanted it to, what he wanted it to evoke.
Well, I think one of the ways the Beatles would write songs is to think of somebody they absolutely loved and write a song sort of almost in emulation, like, oh, here's a kind of song Ray Charles would sing, or here's a kind of song Little Richard would sing. And Oh Darling was a song in Paul's mind that Jackie Wilson could have recorded. They would often do things like that, you know, like they'd hear a Fats Domino single and want to go out and write something that Fats Domino could have recorded.
And then Octopus's Garden, Ringo's second?
Don't Pass Me By, he had something to do with, didn't he?
Yeah.
Ringo was not known as the great songwriter of the Beatles, as we all know, but he did come up with a couple of ideas, and this Octopus's Garden was one of them. And apparently, the origin of it was they were out in Sardinia, and I think they'd been served some octopus meat or something at a meal, and Ringo wasn't too keen on it. But he talked to a fisherman who knew all about octopuses and knew that they did actually build little gardens, as we might call them, and they love to pick up different coloured stones and bring them into their gardens. And Ringo was quite captivated with this idea, particularly as, you know, the Beatles going through a bit of a rough time. He thought, hey, you know, it must be great to have a garden and live under the sea.
The the next track on Abbey Road is I Want You, just pretty simple. But what do you know about what John was trying to do maybe musically with this? Or
I think with a song like I Want You, I think John was... Well, John was getting more and, you know, simplifying more and more in his songs, not going for the, you know, the I Am the Walrus, Goo 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 type of complicated lyric and sort of stripping things down to essentials. And I don't know if that was the influence of Yoko and maybe the kind of Zen Buddhist approach to art. But he, you know, that's a... I think he's prizing the emotion of wanting Yoko above everything else. And he's kind of felt that all he needs to say is, you know, I want you, and just to say it in various different ways. And apparently there was some comedy program where they were making fun of the Beatles songs, and they read this, you know, I want you out in sort of Shakespearean voice and thought this was hilarious. And John, you know, as far as John was concerned, he thought that was a great piece of poetry because it just said them exactly what he felt, and there was no more to add to it.
So you write that Here Comes the Sun kind of spins out of the, in some ways, of the sort of legal hassles of the time. I don't want to get into deep detail about that, but if there's a way to shortcut it or just get to the George Harrison finding respite in the garden.
Yeah. Here Comes the Sun is George, who was a great friend of Eric Clapton's, down at Eric's house in Surrey, just walking around the garden with his guitar, and it was a sunny day. And things with the Beatles are a bit rough, but here he is out in the countryside, the sun's come out, and he just captured that moment by writing Here Comes the Sun.
Now, I do like the story about the genesis of Because... referencing Moonlight Sonata. Tell me a little bit about that.
The story that John told about Because was that it was based on Moonlight Sonata by Beethoven, and that he'd asked Yoko to play the chords backwards. But when I listen to Moonlight Sonata, it actually sounds the same as Because.
You Never Give Me Your Money is the beginning of this first of the two suites. I guess we should talk about them separately, just briefly. Okay. And then maybe we can say a word or two about how they came together, if you have some thoughts about it.
Right. I think the medley on Abbey Road was, that was quite a departure from what they'd done in the past. And it was probably the most, you know, innovative thing they'd done on the album. And it was something that Paul would continue in his work. And that's, you know, taking fragments of songs and having an almost sort of operatic quality to a piece. And this was happening quite a lot with John and Paul, where they'd have bits of songs that weren't good enough on their own, or weren't long enough on their own, or didn't have a chorus, and they would stitch them together. And it worked very effectively on Abbey Road, because some of the pieces you can tell that there's no more to say, that that's just it. You know, added to something else, it does add up to something.
Say a sentence or two about each fragment.
Just so what you know. The first one is
You Never Give Me Your Money.
You Never Give Me Your Money. That's obviously a direct allusion to what was going on at Apple. You know, you only give me your funny feelings. It's interesting. Paul always says that he never writes biographically. You know, he doesn't like to be asked about songs as if they were reports of his own life. But you can't get away from the fact that even though not consciously writing biography, that, you know, so many of these songs are actually about what was going on to them at the time. Sun King was a reference to Louis XIV, who was known as the Sun King. And I believe there was a biography had just come out that year, quite a popular biography about Louis XIV. The guitar sounds very similar to what Fleetwood Mac were doing on particularly on their track Albatross, where the guitarist was Peter Green. Mean Mr. Mustard was a John song, and it was apparently based on a story he'd read about somebody sticking money up his nose and being very mean. I don't know where he got the story from, because I could never find it. I think he might have written it when he was in India, so it could have come from an English-speaking Indian newspaper. But Derek Taylor, who was the Beatles press officer, he told me that that's what it was written about, a story that John had seen. And again, it's got that wonderful sort of cartoony quality to it. It reminds me of there were English comics called The Beano and the Dandy, which John would have been familiar with, and they have characters like Dennis the Menace and Biffo and Mean Mr. Mustard. Just to me, sounds like some sort of character you might have in a comic like that. Yeah, Polythene Pam, I think, was based on two things. One was there was a girl called Pat in Liverpool in the Cavan days who had a habit of chewing polythene and swallowing it. And so they used to call her Polythene Pat. But John did mention in an interview that Polythene Pam was actually based on an incident where there was a poet friend of theirs called Royston Ellis who'd met the Beatles in 1960 up in Liverpool. And when the Beatles were touring in 63, he was living out in Guernsey in the Channel Islands, and he had a girlfriend. And John suggested this idea that they all sleep in the same bed and that they wrap themselves in polythene. He obviously read something in a book about what fun you could have with polythene. So he seems to have contracted these two stories and created this again, cartoon-type character, Polythene Pam. She Came In Through the Bathroom Window is, I believe, based on there were these fans called the Apple Scruffs who used to spend part of the day standing outside Apple offices in Savile Row, just like in the West End of London. And then they might go a few miles north up into St. John's Wood near Abbey Road, where Paul lived, and they'd hang around his house. And he got to know some of these girls quite well. You know, he'd be very polite to them and sign autographs, and some of them would even end up like taking his dog for a walk and going to the shops for him and things like that. But they did get into the house and they did take things, and I think this is based on the story of one of the girls getting up into Paul's bathroom through the window.
Let's see. So then the final suite combines Golden Slumbers, Carry That Weight, and The End. Let's pick a little bit about each.
Golden Slumbers.
Yeah.
Right. Golden Slumbers is almost word for word taken from a poem by a guy called Thomas Dekker, who was, I believe, writing around the time that Shakespeare was writing. And Paul had seen this poem in a book when he was visiting his father, who had remarried. And yeah, he saw this poem and thought, hey, that would make a nice song. So he turned it into Golden Slumbers. What was next?
Carry That Weight.
Carry That Weight is again one of those songs, I think, that subconsciously is referring to the troubles the Beatles were going through at that time. Yeah.
And then what can we say about The End?
The End. Paul said that The End, which is really just a rhyming couplet, was based on the idea that if you look at the end of some of Shakespeare's plays, you would have this sort of final few lines that would almost be like a summary, almost like this is the moral of the play. So he thought he would do something that was like this kind of descriptive couplet that would kind of sum up. I don't know if he thought he was summing up the career or the album or whatever, but it's a great. It does seem to be, in a sense, in a nutshell, what the Beatles were doing, certainly in those latter years. You know, what sort of message they would like to leave behind. Although I was actually wanting to ask Paul about this when I interviewed him. It was one of the questions I had, because I was going to say, Paul, what did that mean? You know, it sounds terribly profound, and yet, you know, what does it mean? It doesn't seem to have any meaning at all. And would it make any difference if you transpose the make and the take, you know, the love you take and the love you make?
And then the show's not quite over, because there's this funny story about how Her Majesty ends up as the last thing that we hear on the record.
I know Paul, I believe Paul wrote Her Majesty while he was up in Scotland at his farmhouse. I think Linda told me that she could remember him writing it up there. It's just a funny little ditty. Although Paul has said in interviews that, you know, when he was a young guy, you know, 12 or 13, the Queen was quite an attractive young woman, you know, and he remembers kind of fancying her at that time. So it's a bit tongue-in-cheek, but, you know, it's a good-humoured little ditty.